Hello, and welcome to a very special series that I'm moderating on diversity, equity, and inclusivity by CME Outfitters. I've had the honor of moderating these programs for the last 3 years, and the feedback and impact of these programs has been fantastic. And I encourage you to continue to keep sending us your ideas and feedback. This CME briefcase is entitled Take Action, Optimizing Equity in Bariatric Surgery Care. This program is supported by an educational grant provided by Johnson & Johnson. My name is Dr. Monica Peek, and I'm the Ellen H. Block Professor of Health Justice in the Section of General Internal Medicine at the University of Chicago, where I also serve as the Vice Chair for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. I'm also the Associate Director of the Chicago Center for Diabetes Translation Research and the Director of Research for the McLean Center of Clinical Medical Ethics. I have been practicing medicine for more than 2 decades, and it really is my honor and privilege to serve the patients on the south side of Chicago, where I see bread and butter medicine of diabetes, hypertension, arthritis, chronic lung disease, and many diseases that are downstream effects of chronic obesity and obesity-related diseases. And we'll learn some new terminologies in this session about that. And so this session is really important to me and hopefully to others that are watching this session to learn how to better manage some of our patient populations. I'm delighted to be joined today by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Dexter Turnquist. Dr. Turnquist, would you mind introducing yourself to our audience today?
Thank you, Dr. Peek. I'm so happy to be here today to discuss this very important topic. My name is Dexter Turnquist. I'm a general surgeon, bariatric surgeon in Houston. Been in practice for over 26 years, and I've seen the tremendous growth in bariatric surgery and awareness around obesity. This has been a life work of mine, and again, addressing the social disparities or disparities in recognition of obesity and its effects on particularly underserved populations has been a passion. So I'm excited to engage with you on this topic. I am the Gulf Coast Regional Medical Director for Bariatric Surgery for HCA here in Houston. And I'm also the medical director for bariatric surgery at two of our institutions here, including the Methodist Hospital, as well as HCA.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here. I'm really looking forward to our session today. Before we begin, I just wanted to note that this program was designed to build upon some foundational concepts that we've already covered in some of our previous DEI activities. And so to learn more about the impact of systemic racism on healthcare and health disparities, as well as how racial and ethnic disparities present in the field of surgical care, we encourage you to engage in these foundational programs, which are linked here. And so before I begin, I want to make to just clarify that as colleagues, Dexter and I decided that we would refer to each other by our first names for this session, just because it's a friendly session amongst colleagues and to sort of create that sense of just friendship and collegiality, we're going to refer to each other by our first names. And so Dexter, I really look forward to our case discussion and our candid conversation today. And so I'm going to start by reviewing our first learning objective for our program, which is to identify health inequities in the diagnosis, treatment, and outcomes of patients eligible for bariatric surgical interventions. And so I'm going to start with an audience response question to sort of gauge your sense of comfort with dealing with this topic for ABCD. And so this is a new term which you may not have been familiar with. And so it stands for adiposity-based chronic disease. And so it's a new diagnostic term for obesity that explicitly identifies a chronic disease. It alludes to a precise pathophysiological basis and avoids some of the stigma and confusion related to the differential use and multiple meanings of the term obesity in and of itself. This term, ABCD, has been endorsed by the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. And so the opening question is, how confident are you in your ability to identify disparities in access to healthcare and other social and economic resources for patients who have ABCD or adiposity-based chronic diseases? All right. And so to highlight some of the disparities in the diagnosis and management of patients with ABCD, let's consider a case example. And so Dexter, would you mind presenting Dakota, whose pronouns are she and her, to our audience today?
Absolutely. Our first patient, Dakota, is a 28-year-old Indigenous American patient. She has not had a consistent PCP and is in for a routine physical examination. Her family history is significant for obesity, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia. She lives at home with her parents and siblings and currently is on Medicaid. She does not drink, smoke, or engage in recreational drug use. She does not engage in regular exercise or physical activity. She's been told since she was young, as a lot of these patients, that she would lose weight if she would just diet and exercise, and endorses having tried several different diets throughout her life.
All right. So you've raised some key reminders for us in her story. And so I think it might be helpful before we move on to ask the audience about ABCD before moving into some of our key discussion points for our diagnosis. And so our question is, which of the following statements regarding disparities in the diagnosis is most accurate? And so for our audience, the answer is C, that ABCD is underdiagnosed in non-Hispanic white patients, male patients, and patients who are over 66 years of age. And so Dexter, would you mind walking us through why C is the right answer and talk a little bit more about disparities in the diagnosis and highlight why that is the right answer?
Absolutely. So it's well known that minorities tend to be underdiagnosed. The reasons for this are multifocal, of course, not the least of which the stigma that's attached to this diagnosis. If we look at the slide, we can see that Indigenous American adults are 50% less likely to have ABCD than non-Hispanic or white adults, that lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender individuals are more likely to be diagnosed with obesity than their heterosexual or cisgender counterparts. ABCD is significantly underdiagnosed, especially in patients with a BMI less than 40, which may be underestimating the effect of obesity on our patients. Certainly in males, non-Hispanic whites, Middle Eastern, and folks over the age of 66, this diagnosis may be less applied. And of course, we know that individuals who are diagnosed with ABCD are more likely to receive treatment. Individuals with an elevated BMI have a rate of ABCD diagnosis as low as 18%. But those diagnosed with the obesity are two times more likely to be offered intervention for their chronic disease.
18% is pretty low, considering how prevalent the condition is in our community, which sort of highlights the importance of having it in our EMR and how easy it is to have it automatically calculated once the nurses or MAs automatically put, you know, the weight in there. It can be sort of automatically generated. And so what a sort of force multiplier it is for physicians to be able to just see the BMI in there based on information that's already in the chart.
Monica, you know, establishing the diagnosis is so important. We can't treat it if we don't recognize it. For purposes of documentation, in the event that we want to treat this significant healthcare problem going forward, we have to know the history. We have to know where the patients have been and where they are. And so having that diagnosis is so important as the first step in getting treatment and recognizing that this is truly a healthcare problem, significant healthcare problem.
Yes. And the one last thing I wanted to just sort of highlight or push up in the conversation was the underdiagnosis in the elderly. And because we typically think about the frail elderly and how many, it's more common for people to start losing weight on that sort of tail end of life. And so we, I think, frequently stop thinking about or looking for overweight and obesity and ABCD as people age, yet it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And so it's important for us to continue to look for those things that may be driving, you know, hypertension and some of the other chronic diseases that we continue to see in primary care and then subsequently in subspecialty care as well. So thanks so much for just helping to us to think about the underdiagnosed populations that we should sort of have additionally on our radar. And so let's go back to Dakota and her case. And before we do so, I'm going to ask another audience question. The question is, which of the following statements regarding disparities in treatment of ABCD is the most accurate? And so the answer is D. So Dexter, can you tell us why D is the best answer of many of these options? And some of them sounded pretty good.
So there's a complex set of factors at play, not the least of which is a patient's socioeconomic status. We know that patients who have a lower socioeconomic status are less likely to help to access the healthcare system to begin with. And in accessing the healthcare system, there are certain biases that are innate. If you are coming from an area where you may not be as trusting of physicians, you may end up with, and that's for various reasons, you may find confirmational bias when you go to see a physician, particularly when you're talking about something as sensitive as weight. We know that getting healthcare coverage for obesity and obesity-related diseases is a challenge. It is not a universally approved or recognized process. So when accessing the healthcare system, the biases are present, and overcoming those barriers can sometimes be a bit of a challenge. Being on government assistance may lead to some biased opinions prior to the patient presenting. And so forming opinions of what's best for a patient may be steered by some of those preconceived notions. Is Indigenous Americans are more likely, I would suggest, to undergo more invasive procedure, perhaps a gastric bypass, or not offered bariatric surgery at all, because of the notion that Indigenous people may not be able to afford quality vitamins or medications, may not be able to find readily healthcare should there be some adverse or side effect. That the diets may not be able to follow the diet as well as we would like because of food deserts or lack of quality food. I think all of those things kind of play into why someone maybe choose to not do a bariatric surgery at all, and certainly will influence which procedure they might be offered.
So does that mean that A is correct, that Medicare and Medicaid have widely adopted coverage of anti-obesity medications and bariatric surgery?
Absolutely not. This is really quite an issue across our country, in that there's still a fair amount of stigma associated with obesity and overweight. There's precious little coverage for obesity disease. It is still thought of as a lifestyle disease that, again, as within our case, Dakota, if you just eat a little less, everything would be great. And we know that that's not true. We know that there are actual physiologic things that are going on that make this much more complex. Nonetheless, Medicare, Medicaid, and really a lot of the insurance companies are not providing coverage for obesity, or make it so hard to get it done that it becomes not obtainable. Particularly when it comes to medications, the medications are expensive. And so there's definitely been a lag in coverage for these medications, and really obesity care in general.
Yeah, there are some states that are exceptions to this rule, but certainly the coverage from the government sector has lagged behind some of the private insurance sector, which then creates health inequities, because it's the more lower income and socially marginalized groups that are relying more on government insurance. So thank you for helping us think about that. Let's check back on our case with Dakota. And can you tell us more about her case?
All right. So Dakota, she comes in again with a blood pressure of 124/86, her heart rate's at 88 beats per minute, Dakota is 5 foot 9 inches and weighs 240 pounds, which gives her a BMI of 35.4 kilograms. Her healthcare provider orders labs. She gets a CBC, a lipid panel, A1C, ionized calcium, parathyroid hormone, a vitamin D level, B12 folate, iron studies, including ferritin, and other routine type labs. The patient endorses years of feeling like she's been struggling with her weight, and sometimes thinks she may binge eat. She has been prescribed GLP-1, I guess, in the past, but never started the medications because, like most of our patients, or a lot of our patients, she couldn't afford them. Her insurance wouldn't cover it because the patient doesn't have diabetes. It's a common thing.
Yes.
Most insurance companies at this point will only prescribe a GLP-1 if there's some sort of diabetes diagnosis, which, again, we know is an end effect of A, B, C, D. It'd be much better than if we were treated before, but insurance companies certainly don't necessarily work that way. So if we look at some of the issues here, we know that Indigenous Americans are 30 to 40% less likely to receive bariatric surgery compared to non-Hispanic and white patients. Indigenous Americans are less likely to have a laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy as opposed to our non-Hispanic, white, indigenous patients, despite it being the most common procedure performed in the United States at this point. Patients from underserved racial and ethnic populations are less likely to be offered bariatric surgery and anti-obesity medications. Medicare Part D excludes weight loss drugs from coverage. Only a handful of Medicaid programs in the United States, 16 states, cover obesity medications. Mm-hmm. And individuals who have private commercial insurance are more likely to undergo bariatric procedures. Race and insurance are the strongest predictors of receiving bariatric surgery. When we think about this, it sort of makes sense. Certainly, insurance coverage is very important in terms of achieving coverage or having this bariatric surgery or weight loss medications covered. As we can see with our patient, Dakota, she was offered a GLP-1, but the biggest problem was that she's unable to afford that medication, so she never picked it up. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much the story of our patients. If we think back, in losing weight, it really does take a fair amount of effort to get it done. And just relying on eat less, exercise more is really probably not going to accomplish our goal. This is a comprehensive problem, requires a comprehensive solution, including medications or perhaps surgery. And so having honest, open discussions with our patients are so important.
Absolutely. And one thing that we don't yet know about this case, and we might not, we'll see as the case proceeds, is whether or not Dakota is presenting for care in the Indian Health Service or outside of the Indian Health Service. But as we're talking about barriers related to insurance and healthcare and costs, that represents another potential barrier as far as the Indian Health Service being sort of chronically underfunded. And so being part of the safety net that is sort of underserved as well. And so just like people who are relying on government insurance and those government insurance programs, just not having the funding and having to figure out how can we stretch our limited dollars, and these medications are very expensive. Maybe we should prioritize medicines that are cheaper that can reach a larger number of people. The Indian Health Service is having to make very difficult decisions about when they're sort of restrained or constrained with their resources. And so the reason that private insurance companies can cover these more is because they have more resources. They have people with higher incomes that are paying, more into them. And so this gets back to the issue of structural inequities, who's being covered, and all of those sort of issues. And so having an Indigenous person allows us to think about social inequities in lots of different ways as they may be navigating the healthcare system. So thanks again for helping us to think about some of those issues. Let's go back to our clinical case and see how she's doing.
So Dakota, when we get her labs back, her triglyceride, it's at 250 milligrams per deciliter. Her LDL, it's 165. Her A1C is 5.7. Vitamin D is at 10. And her ferritin is 3. Her screening for depression and disorders of eating scales are negative for any significant disordered eating. She does have anxiety, and her PHQ-9 is positive for depression. Her healthcare provider discussed treatment options with her for her ABCD. So the significant things here, she is got a little bit of a triglyceride problem, so her cholesterol is a little bit off, but she's not diabetic, which again leads into the further comments regarding obtaining coverage for the GLP-1, which is the popular weight loss medications at this point. So we have to think about what's available to our patient here. She's got a little bit of anxiety and depression, which is not uncommon amongst our patient population. And so very important that we take all those things into account when we start thinking about how we're going to treat Dakota going forward.
Absolutely. And so let's use this opportunity once more to check in with our audience and see what they would do. So given Dakota's laboratory values and her healthcare provider's assessment, what treatment would be most appropriate as the next step for this patient? And so for our audience, the optimal answer would be B, bariatric surgery. And so Dexter, as someone who is a surgeon and performs bariatric surgery, can you talk us through why that would be the best option?
Of course. So our patient had been prescribed a GLP-1 before, and it became very apparent what the issue is there. These medications are very expensive, and being that she is on government assistance and perhaps in a food desert, perhaps not easy access to healthcare, the ongoing healthcare needs associated with medication management and close supervision required to have long-term success with medical management may not really be an option for her. Some of the other medications are just not appropriate for her. Metformin, she's not diabetic. And whilst metformin can induce some weight loss, it's probably not enough to make this a real good option for our patient.
Just sort of on that borderline for prediabetes, but just kind of walking that fine line.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And we know the side effects of orlistat, probably not tolerable in the long run, even if it is available. Surgery is a great option in Dakota for a number of reasons. First of all, being that she is where she is, there's not a whole lot of follow-up that's required of her from day-to-day medical management. She does need to take vitamins, but short of that, she's back to her normal life and normal diet. Surgery will induce a reliable weight loss for her and will control a fair amount of her comorbid conditions. Her borderline diabetes will resolve. Her cholesterol is likely to come back down. And again, her weight loss is fairly predictable. In the long run, it has been shown that surgery actually is a much more cost-effective way of dealing with this long-term vexing problem than continued medical management, as in the medications are just expensive and adherence is likely to suffer as a result of that.
You know, this is, I think, eye-opening to probably a lot of people who are watching, that we so early in the course go to a surgical option for someone whose BMI is 35, not 45 or 50. And so I think that's really an interesting case study for us to examine. So thank you for walking us through that scenario and thinking about the pros and cons of the various medical treatments and lifestyle and social factors and why surgery might be a great, basically first option for some patients. And so can you talk us through walk us through some of the disparities in outcomes and some of the examples and things that we need to be thinking about as clinicians?
So as with any medical treatment, these are not standalone type interventions. And so certainly having a patient who is able to follow a plan that should be outlined to them in any good bariatric program is important. So we find that patients from a lower economic status, patients with a lower educational level, poor general nutritional knowledge, reduced access to care, inability to afford the post-op supplements, the vitamins which are very important, and low healthcare literacy skills are more likely to run into nutritional deficiencies and really put them at higher risk of developing adverse outcomes from their weight loss procedures. Among those who receive surgery, we know that non-Hispanic white patients show a higher percentage of weight loss than our Black and Latino patients. Black patients and women are more likely to have vitamin deficiencies after bariatric surgery than other groups. Mm-hmm. Patients from underserved racial and ethnic populations are more likely to have postoperative surgical complications and increased mortality following bariatric surgery than non-Hispanic groups. And if we think about that, it is still fairly intuitive as to why that might happen. Again, adherence to a plan is very important. And so being sure that your patients understand the rigors of weight loss surgery is so important. This is not a genetic issue. It is a educational issue. So having a program that's full-rounded that addresses all the concerns are so important. In our patient, Dakota, several things came up as we were discussing. She is in an underserved area. She has a lower socioeconomic status, and her understanding about nutrition and what's required to overcome that may be impaired. Again, her best advice that's been given to her is exercise and eat less. Obviously, that's not going to be enough to take care of this problem. And so it's very important that we, when we think about surgery, that it is a comprehensive approach and we're involving all of our healthcare providers, including our psychologists and dietitians in that care.
Yes. And one of the other things that we have been talking about a lot in this program are the importance of having case managers and care coordinators, behavioral specialists and other people who can particularly help patients when we're thinking about addressing those issues of health literacy, who can make sure that people are understanding the plan, that we're taking a shared decision-making approach so that we're doing teach back and making sure that patients really understand not just what they're getting into on the front end, but all the instructions, you know, all the way through. And so, like you said, we have to do all the steps to get to surgery, but then all the steps after surgery. And so how can we sort of wrap the whole program around patients to make sure that they can optimally succeed and not see sort of some of these disparities in outcomes after surgery as well?
Absolutely. It's so important that there's a team associated with weight loss efforts. And that includes surgical as well as medical weight loss. Prescribing medications alone will not solve the problem. So it's very important that all of our partners are involved.
Great. Well, it is time for us to move on to our next learning objective. That was an excellent first objective. And so that brings us to our second learning objective, which as a member of the healthcare team is to implement actionable, collaborative strategies to improve health equity. So once again, I'm going to start this section by asking the audience another confidence question. And so you'll see the question on the screen. How confident are you in your ability to utilize an appropriate screener for social drivers of health that consider drivers things like food insecurity, housing instability, health literacy, things like that, when caring for your patients who require bariatric surgery? All right. So to help the audience with actionable strategies to improve equity for all patients, I think we should first consider actionable strategies for screening for social drivers of health for patients undergoing bariatric surgery. And so, Dexter, can you give us some of your insight and experience in how screening for social drivers of health, for social determinants of health, may impact a patient who is undergoing bariatric surgery?
Absolutely. It's so important that we can consider the whole patient when we decide on a course of therapy. Our patients, of course, come with all sorts of backgrounds, and their biases are informed by their communities. Firstly, as in our patient, again, back to Dakota, she's been told all her life that really all she needs to do is eat less and be more active, and it would solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And so she comes with the baggage of feeling the personal failure, that this may be a personal weakness for me. And so she's coming and exposing herself at that point to potential, in her mind, ridicule. And so we have to think about what's the patient's, what biases the patient's coming with, and be sure that we are not confirming or doubling down on that feeling. So, secondly, we have family members, we have friends, we have to think about our social groups, think about our church groups, and how they may affect a patient's feeling about their weight and efforts to lose weight. Of course, our communities, again, are very important. It is where we go for affirmation and support. And if our communities are not supportive of us, this can certainly be a problem. And of course, again, can we afford this operation? Can we get the medications we need to maintain our health long term? So all of these things play into what is appropriate for any patient, how we're going to treat a patient. It is so important. I think probably the most important part of it is the interpersonal relationship and the interpersonal relationship with yourselves. Again, we know that most of our patients have been through this for a long period of time. They've been carrying this weight and dealing with the stigma. And so their responses are important. We know that there can be anything from self-sabotage to overdoing it, starvation diets and unhealthy behaviors. That certainly will affect how our patients are going to respond to any sort of intervention. So it's very important, again, that we involve the full team, that we're looking at the psychological as well as social situations.
Absolutely. And one of the things I think it's important for us to, as you're saying, to think about is that patients live in larger social and structural environments. And so if we are thinking about something like food insecurity, and because food is so integrally related to so many chronic diseases, and so a lot of times when people are food insecure, they have adiposity related or adiposity based chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension, arthritis, gallstones, et cetera, and, may benefit from multiple health points having from a lower BMI. But those very people may have behaviors that have adapted to that food insecurity with a feast or famine based on when they may be receiving food assistance through WIC or SNAP or things like that. And so we've shown that for people who have diabetes, for example, they may have hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia, depending on how they're eating based on the food, the monetary assistance they get to help with their food because of food insecure. And so people who are food insecure may have developed dietary behaviors based on their economic insecurity. And so when they then go on to have bariatric surgery, those patterns that have been driven by economic pressures, by economic insecurities, those behaviors still have to now particularly be addressed because, you know, feast and famine behaviors are not good for someone who's had bariatric surgery. And so again, these have to be thought of not as individual failures, but these are survival strategies and given environments that make you have constrained choices. And so thinking about the larger picture in which people are forced to make difficult choices. And so that's why understanding them and not blaming the patient, but understanding how and why they came to make those choices that they made, the best of poor options, and then trying to figure out how we can have a better plan as they move forward. And so, yeah, so thank you for sort of putting that into a larger context.
Right. It's so important that we're non-judgmental of our patients, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, these slights in the language is so, they're so sensitive. They pick up on the slightest things, right? Because again, remember, this is a chronic disease and it carries a fair amount of social stigma, whether we like it or not, it does. And so we have to be very careful in how we communicate with our patients, but we most certainly have to take all of these things into consideration when we're meeting with our patient.
Absolutely. And the data has shown that screening for social determinants of health can improve patient outcomes in a number of ways, including prior to surgery and addressing these things after surgical interventions. And so can you present some of the ways in which patient outcomes may be influenced by social determinants of health and how we may think about those related to bariatric surgery through sort of a racial and ethnic lens?
Certainly. Socioeconomic status, of course, is very important. And again, as we've stated earlier, folks of lower socioeconomic status are likely to not do as well as our more affluent counterparts. And again, for all the reasons that we've already talked about. Certainly, again, non-Hispanic white patients are 1.5 times more likely to complete a bariatric surgery than the non-Hispanics from underserved racial or ethnic populations. Most likely, again, having to do with access. We know that Medicaid insurance and receiving social security disability benefits have been associated with suboptimal weight loss after bariatric surgery. And again, this would tend to make sense, again, considering, again, the things we've just talked about, food insecurities, what types of food are available, and eating behaviors surrounding that. Bariatric surgery is clinically appropriate, irrespective of the patient education and income, race, or insurance status. Yet there's underutilization of surgery for patients in high-risk groups. And of course, again, this is multifactorial. Again, we talk about intrapersonal and interpersonal relationships, community associations. If you think about, you know, our church group, there may be you start to lose weight and, you know, your friends are asking you, what's the problem? Why are you doing that? Family members want to know, you know, you're losing weight. Why are you losing weight? You don't look good, you know, particularly among certain ethnicities that weight loss can be seen as a negative thing.
You may have an illness.
In some cases, something must be wrong. And so those are all kind of things that we have to think about when we speak with our patients. It is not infrequent that my patients will tell me, well, I only want to lose, you know, 50 pounds and they're currently at 350 pounds. And you go, well, that's not going to get you where you need to be. But my social group, my church, they're going to think something's wrong with me. They're going to think poorly of me because I had surgery and it's a cop-out. All of those things come into play when we're having this discussion. That's the subtext that's going on when we think, as clinicians, we think about health and what's the best thing for you from a health standpoint. But we can't ignore the social cues, the social influences that are going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So much. So all the social cultural factors are so important to the patient and therefore their success along their journey to wellness. So I'm now going to ask the audience another confidence question about utilizing team-based care or using a collaborative approach. And we had talked a little bit earlier about that in managing people who have adiposity-based chronic disease. And so again, feel free to be as honest as possible. These results are anonymous and it just kind of helps us get a sense of where our audience is. And so the question is, how confident are you in your ability to manage adiposity-based chronic disease and related conditions with a team-based or collaborative approach? Okay, and so remember, we still have a patient case, Dakota, who is not unlike many patients that I see in my own practice. She's a great example of the importance of screening for social drivers of health. And so I'm going to go back to you, Dexter, to return to our patient case.
Thank you, Margaret. So Dakota, her healthcare provider has done an appropriate social determinants of health screening. The patient has had difficulty affording food and lives in a food desert. Very important. She worries about relapsing into old habits based on familiar food preferences. She has concerns about being able to afford follow-up appointments or nutritional supplements post-surgery, but is hesitant to talk about it because she doesn't want to be denied surgery. Patient denies some anxiety, expresses some anxiety about undergoing surgery. And Dakota is a very typical patient that we see. And all of these things are, again, so important. We've gone over most of this already. But some of the things that, the anxieties that we do see is, again, family. The family, old habits are hard to break, as I say. It is impossible to separate yourself from your culture. So all of these things are incredibly important and, again, makes having a team-based approach and culturally congruent healthcare providers involved in the care of these patients.
Absolutely. So considering that the team has now screened for social issues for this case, it sounds like there's some actionable strategies that the team can now take to improve the outcomes in this case. So what can they do?
Certainly, most importantly, this is a team-based sport, and so we must have a full-rounded team, particularly when we're considering underserved populations. So having a case manager to assist the patient with insurance and follow-up support, transportation, dietitian, supplementation coverage, all these things are so important. Referring the patient to a culturally congruent dietitian or psychologist after surgery can make a huge difference. We talked about the increased risk associated with our minority populations post-bariatric surgery. Again, a lot of this has to do with the messaging. So having a congruent, socially, a culturally congruent dietitian or psychologist resource is so important to these patients. Assisting patients with locating food banks and other food sources to ensure access to healthy choices. Very important. Referring patients, again, to therapists to help them through the adversity, through their community relationship changes that are going to happen. Body image. Again, in cultures, this is an extremely important thing, and the value placed on thinness in that community, it's different than a provider may be thinking. Certainly lifestyle change is going to occur. And again, this all affects patients' quality of life and how they feel about or see the world. Mm-hmm. So looking at our GAD-7s and our PHQ scores, important to follow along as these patients are proceeding on their weight loss journey.
Absolutely.
Of course, involving our PCPs, again, you must have a team when we're considering the long-term health of our patients. So the primary care physicians are not, I'm not excluding from the surgical portion of this care. So very important that we maintain a good working relationship throughout.
So let's check back in with Dakota to see what action steps, given all of those possibilities, that your care team has taken to accomplish some of these goals and address her pre-op needs. And so what can you tell us has actually happened with our hypothetical patient?
All right, so the case manager as insured that Dakota has the insurance to cover this procedure. So that's one anxiety and hurdle that we can get across. But in addition, Dakota has to be able to get to her appointment. So arranging transportation, very important. Mm-hmm. And of course, the insurance piece needs to be renewed and continually followed for after surgery care. Dakota and her family are scheduled for regular appointments with a culturally congruent dietitian prior to procedure. Dakota verbalizes her understanding that food banks and food options that are available within her neighborhood for her and her family members. The case manager assists with transportation for her post-surgical appointments, her dietitian appointments, lab appointments, collaborative care with the team as she progresses through her journey again. The case manager ensures insurance renewal status and follow-ups with Dakota on appropriate vitamins and prescribed treatments. Dakota and her family continue to work with a culturally congruent dietitian and healthcare professional, mental healthcare professional. It's underestimated the effects of weight loss on a person's view of themselves and their place in community, highly undervalued. And so very important that our psychologists, therapists, healthcare professionals involved in the ongoing care. So again, really is a team-based approach to the management of our patient. All of the healthcare providers have a very important role to play in the overall success of our patient. The general practitioners who will be following Dakota for the long term, maintaining her general health, as well as monitoring for things like vitamin deficiencies or disordered eating, anxiety, depression around body image. Again, so important that our general practitioners are keeping up with our patient. Again, our dietitians providing culturally appropriate suggestions for diet, and sources of food. We talked about our psychologist and healthcare providers. We talked about our bariatric surgeon. It's important that our bariatric surgeons continue to follow our patients on the long term, as we want to head off behavioral issues or vitamin deficiencies, nutritional issues that may come up before they become a real problem. And then, of course, our case managers, particularly in our service and underinsured patients, has access for the long term.
Great. So thank you, Dexter, for helping us think about how the whole team just wraps its care around patients. It's not just about the surgery itself, but it's about how you provide care preoperatively and get patients ready for that. And also post-operatively, so they have the optimal chances for success around their, and what you call their weight loss journey. And so they're thinking about, you know, meeting with all these different team members before the surgery even happens, and then continuing after. And so Dakota has, you know, her primary care provider, her dietitian, her behavioral specialist or psychologist, a bariatric surgeon, a case manager, all of these things, and people, infrastructure with resources. You mentioned she had someone who could make sure that her insurance was covered. And so that was an anxiety reducer just in and of itself. Someone who could make sure she had transportation. And so all of these things to make sure that she was set up for success. We want to be able to do that for any major chronic condition that people have, but particularly for these unique sort of once in a lifetime experiences that they're going to have as part of their healthcare journey. And so particularly leaning into patients, their race, ethnicity, culture, and how that may impact their healthcare plan, how they understand their disease, how it's experienced within their community, and what that means as far as adherence, understanding, and implementation of that plan is really critical for us as healthcare professionals to understand so that we can then help them create a plan that is best for everyone. And so all of this is really important for us to be thinking about. And so thank you so much, Dexter, for helping to sort of walk us through what that might look like, and how, and helping us to understand that it's so important for us to create safe spaces for patients to have non-judgmental spaces to be able to talk about these issues where they don't feel judged, where they can share their own beliefs and concerns with us. It's important for us to be able to ask our patients about the social drivers of their health, and help to specifically fill in those care gaps around transportation or insurance or food, with case managers and therapists and dietitians, and to be able to set goals for treatment with a shared decision making in a shared decision making way, so that our patients can buy into the plan of care, and that everyone's on the same page about what's going to be best for patients given that sociocultural context, and then we've all communicated about what that plan is and updated the primary care team as well. Dexter, are there any other key points that I've forgotten or any final thoughts that you want to add for our audience that's listening today?
I think you've driven it home quite nicely. I think if I would like to leave the audience with one important thing, and that is to meet your patient where they are. I think we have, based on our own biases and our own life experiences, expectations as to what this journey should be like for our patients, which may not be so. And so listening to our patients, allow them to share with us their anxieties and to be open to accepting that and non-judgmental is so important in the success of these patients long-term. So thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. So I hope we've shared some very actionable strategies with our learners today while working through our patient case. And so one last audience response question about confidence. And so now, after sitting with us for about an hour, how confident are you in your ability to identify disparities in access to healthcare and other social and economic resources for patients who have adiposity-based chronic disease? But please be honest with your responses. And our next question is following up about confidence in your ability to use appropriate screening for social drivers of health. And so how confident are you about that for patients who require bariatric surgery? And then our last question is, how confident are you in your ability to manage adiposity-based chronic disease and related conditions with a team-based or collaborative approach? All right. So, Dexter, this was an excellent discussion, and I really see the impact of obesity on my patients every day. I've learned a lot of new things today. Adiposity-based chronic disease is everywhere. I see it every day. I have clinic tomorrow, and I will tell you that probably 8 out of 10 of the patients will have adiposity-based chronic diseases. These are things that I think about all the time. The one thing that I will say that I have taken from this session is to be thinking about bariatric surgery as an option much early in the course than I had previously. And so I hope that people who have been with us for this past hour have taken many other things from this session. So I'm going to try and summarize our goals for today with SMART goals. And those are goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And so that's what I hope that our audience will be able to take away from this presentation and apply to their very own practices. And so those are to first identify disparities in the diagnosis and treatment of ABCD. Second, to identify the impact of social drivers of health in ABCD. Third, to integrate a plan to discuss all treatment options with patients who have ABCD, including not only nutrition and physical activity, but also surgical options as well as medicine. And then last, to consider team-based strategies in the care of patients with adiposity-based chronic diseases to address inequities in treatment outcomes. So this CMEO briefcase is one of a four-part CME CE initiative, and we really hope that you'll take advantage of and participate in all the activities in this series. These activities cover a range of strategies to address racial and ethnic disparities across therapeutic areas, and I really encourage you to join us for the entire initiative. By participating in these activities, you demonstrate your own personal commitment to improving health equity for all patients. The CMEO D&I Hub also has a number of resources available to you to help further your education on diversity, equity, and inclusivity. So last, Dexter, again, I want to thank you for joining me and having such a robust conversation. It was wonderful. Thank you again for all of the work that you do down in the Gulf Coast for all of your patients. And thank you for just helping us all who have been part of this conversation to learn more about how we can help our patients who have adiposity-based chronic diseases and some of the bariatric treatment options.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's been a pleasure. I hope that we can move the ball just a little bit in helping people to understand where our patients are and, again, meet our patients where they live. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. So to receive credit for this activity, please complete the post-test and evaluation. We really appreciate your feedback, and we want to hear from you, what you liked, how we can improve, and what additional topics you'd like for us to address. And so I want to sincerely thank you, our audience, for your own personal commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusivity education, because together we can strive to provide the best and most equitable care to our patients, particularly those who are most underserved. So thank you again for joining us today.